Today we have a very interesting session. I asked Professor Anthony King, who I will introduce in a moment, to speak to us about his book, Who Governs Britain, because I thought whatever the outcome of the election was, the whole thesis of that book was, in a sense, perhaps it doesn't matter as much as it might, because the question of who governs Britain isn't necessarily governed by elections only. And that is what he's going to talk to us about today. He said to me that if after that, in question and answer, you want to ask him about the election, he'd be delighted to talk about that then. But the whole purpose is to examine the thesis of his book, Who Governs Britain, which I think is a fascinating thesis, and I'm looking forward to hearing from him. If I could briefly introduce him, he's a professor of government at the University of Essex. He's a Canadian by birth. He came to Britain as a Rhodes Scholar and stayed on. He moved to Essex during the 1960s. He served on the original Committee on Standards in Public Life, the Nolan Committee, and on the Royal Commission on the Reform of the House of Lords, which, who knows, may become a live subject again in the months ahead for various reasons. His books include the one he's going to speak about, Who Governs Britain, but he's written others, as many as you will know. I'm not going to read out all the titles. But I might just say Professor King is a Fellow of the British Academy and a Foreign Honorary Member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. I'm going to ask him to speak to us for about 30 minutes, and then he'll take questions for half an hour. And after that, as usual, I will end the meeting exactly at 2 o'clock so people can get away. But I'm delighted to be able to introduce Professor Anthony King.
I'm going to talk standing up. The unselfish reason for that is that people can hear me and see me better than they would be able to otherwise. The selfish reason is that I must have Spanish blood in me because I tend to go to sleep after lunch. and you may go to sleep, any one of you, or indeed all of you. I hereby absolve you of any blame for doing that. But if I fell asleep, that would be rather embarrassing, and it would be more likely to happen if I were sitting down. Let me begin with an apology and a confession. The apology is that in an organization called the Global Strategy Forum, one shouldn't be talking exclusively about this country. One shouldn't be parochial, but that's what I'm about to be. And I also apologize for the fact that I'm not going to talk, at least to begin with, about the election, because the letter from Michael didn't invite me to talk about the election. It invited me to talk in and around the book that he just referred to. The confession is that I've become, rather to my surprise, something of a heretic as regards the way in which this country is governed, to the point of being almost an apostate. I've changed my views radically, rather to my surprise, as time has gone on. Until recently, I was a great and pretty unqualified admirer of our political and governmental institutions. I think essentially for two reasons. One was that I admired the decisiveness, the capacity to take decisions that arose from the fact that typically, and most commonly, you had in power, in London, a single-party majoritarian government. And that meant that, unlike in many other countries, which I won't bother to name, you had a government that was capable of governing, of taking decisions in the national interest as perceived by the people in power. The other reason that I was an admirer of the system was that precisely because you had a centralized government, you had a government in which power was concentrated, as long as ministers had a majority in the House of Commons, those ministers could be held to account. If you look at an awful lot of countries and you imagine the situation of voters in those countries, they have a problem because they don't know to whom to attribute things that have gone wrong, so that if they want to throw the rascals out, they're not sure who the rascals are. Slow pace, for example, with which healthcare reform was introduced in the United States. Who was to blame? At was never entirely clear. Well, I no longer admire the system, as I said, in the way that I once did, for three reasons. The first is that I had failed to pick up, and maybe it wasn't so true once upon a time, that if you have a system in which it's easy to take decisions, it's almost as easy to take the wrong ones as the right ones. And Michael was too polite to refer to the predecessor book, to the one he did refer to, called The Blunders of Our Governments. And I was attracted to work on that book precisely because it had come to my notice over a period of time that British governments blundered frequently. This will sound like a boast, it's not, and it's an expression of astonishment, but that book has sold, and it's quite a thick, serious tome. It's not solemn, I hope, but it's serious. It sold upwards of 50,000 copies. So I think it must have had some effect on people. It must have rung a bell somewhere. The paperback edition has a shot at listing some of the blunders committed by the coalition government. And I've been struck by the fact that I've addressed a lot of audiences of roughly this size, sometimes larger, of civil servants, some of them senior civil servants. And I've listed the blunders, and it's yet to happen that anybody has queried whether something I had identified as a blunder was a blunder. People seem to accept that, beginning with the poll tax, which is the first one mentioned in the book and one of the most spectacular, the fact that things have gone wrong is very widely acknowledged, so that people don't defend the way in which the Lansley NHS reforms were introduced. They don't defend the way in which IT projects have been handled over a long period of years. They don't pretend that it's highly desirable to have aircraft carriers with no aircraft. I mean, that's generally thought to be slightly strange. Still in the field of defense, government has the power to cut the size of the regular army. It has the power to say it will try to recruit enough reservists to make up for the people who have been axed, but it can't actually do it. And there's a good deal of evidence that it's not being proving able to do it. And I could go on and on and on. If you enjoy this kind of literature, I do invite the reports of the Public Accounts Committee when it was chaired by the estimable and formidable Margaret Hodge. Notice one thing about those reports, which is that although they were often highly critical of the Conservative Lib Dem coalition, every single report published by the Public Accounts Committee under Margaret Hodge's chairmanship were unanimous. They were signed off by everybody, including the Lib Dems, including the Conservatives on the committee. So that's the first point. My previous admiration for the system was founded in the belief that governments didn't very often screw up, and it's become clearer and clearer that, at least latterly, I won't make any historical comparisons, it screwed up far too often. The second explanation for my apostasy is somewhat more subtle, and it's this. If you have a capital G government that has an overall majority in the House of Commons, that's capable of governing, that hoards power, and I don't mean that negatively, I just mean that factually, that the government is the center of the system, then it follows that they are the rascals, they can be thrown out, and they're very highly exposed. And what's the consequence of that? It's to cause decisiveness to be matched by timidity. And one of the striking features of the UK system of government over a considerable period of years is the number of wicked issues, as they're called in Whitehall, that officials and ministers have been reluctant to tackle what Charles Clarke calls the too difficult box. take a few pretty obvious examples. Extending airport capacity in the southeast of England. The Roskill Commission was appointed in 1960 to look at this, made recommendations which were turned down, and it's gone on and on and on. The London Underground hoardings are plastered with adverts for different solutions to this question, which has been out there for a very long time. Meanwhile, the Dutch have built Schiphol, the French have built Charles de Gaulle, and so on and so forth. The problems, which are enormous, posed by an aging population. Problems having to do, obviously, with the NHS, but also with social care and so on. Demographers have been pointing out that this was going on ever since I can remember, and I'm part of the aging population. But successive governments have found this very difficult to tackle, as indeed it is. I'm not disputing that, but an allegedly decisive political system hasn't done that very satisfactorily. Similarly, with the long-term funding of the NHS, it's quite clear that on the present basis, the NHS is going to be fiscally difficult for the foreseeable future, and indeed probably well beyond that. And yet that particular problem has not been tackled head-on. Climate change, equally, is something that on the whole people agree about, that there is such a thing, that it is, to use the grand term, anthropogenic, that we're partly responsible for it, but precious little has been done about it, not just by governments in this country, but also by governments elsewhere, but certainly by governments in this country. Mental health, for example, another no-no area. Short-termism, I think it's fair to say, has reigned, partly because governments know they're so likely to be held responsible for anything that they do that is unpopular. The third reason for my disenchantment is of a completely different character. It's very simply stated that when the capital G government of the United Kingdom was responsible for an awful lot that went on in the United Kingdom, it was perfectly reasonable to point the finger of blame, or indeed to shout paeans of praise, at the people in power. But one of the central themes of the book, to which Michael alluded a moment ago, is that it's no longer reasonable to hold UK governments responsible for a very large proportion of those things that most intimately affect people in the UK. That's for a number of reasons, all of them obvious. One is the devolution of power to Edinburgh and Cardiff and Belfast. People still talk about the National Health Service. There's no such thing as the National Health Service in the UK. There are four National Health Services run along different lines, sometimes radically different lines, in the four nations of the UK. Devolution within the UK, and of course, for good or ill, we can differ about that, the handing over of very substantial powers that have an effect on the people who live in this country to the European Union. The surrender of some of our so-called sovereignty to the EU. The courts. I don't know whether you've noticed this, but I'm intrigued by the fact that once upon a time, people never talked in this country about the three branches of government, the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary. It was a language that was known, but it wasn't spoken. But now we hear that language used all the time. Why? Because the judges are now players in the political game in a way that they never were. We can talk about why that should have happened, but that it has happened. The phrase judicial review, you never saw in a newspaper a generation ago. Now you can hardly pick up a newspaper without seeing that somebody is going to claim judicial review of something or other. So the judges matter more, and of course, the UK economy has always been, more than many others, embedded in a world market economy, but that world market economy has become more interpenetrated more intertwined, every bit of it more dependent on other bits of it than has been true for a very long time. I get up early, going back to my Spanish blood. I get up early and often listen to Farming It Today, and then when I'm done with that, that's the EU bit, I listen to the financial news. And it's very interesting that if currency fluctuations that involve sterling are almost always attributed to things that have nothing to do with Britain or sterling, but have to do with developments elsewhere in the outside world. Market forces are hugely important. And I think, by the way, I say this semi-parenthetically, that one of the reasons for the alienation of so many members of the general public from our political class, one of the reasons, is because people still campaign in elections and talk between elections as though UK governments were capable of moving mountains, which they can't. I mean, Labour, during this election campaign, talked about a better plan, a better Britain. Well, I mean, leaving aside how you voted in the election, that was simply over-promising. And I think people have picked up that that language is no longer appropriate. So what might be done? The question that always arises, and it's appropriate that should arise. Let me suggest that there are certain institutional things that might usefully be done without upending the UK's constitution. I think the idea of overall constitutional reform is probably simply not on the agenda and doesn't need to be there, in my view. One is that relates to Parliament. It's well known that Parliament is a noisy debating society. It's well known that it's a labour exchange where you get your ministers from. It's well known as being a partisan bear pit. And it's fairly widely known, but should be more widely known, that as a legislative assembly, it's just about useless. It is one of the weaker. There are a lot of weak parliaments around, by the way, but certainly the British Parliament is. Its capacity to deal with government legislation, let alone to initiate legislation from within itself, is very limited indeed. And one can think of various ways of dealing with that. For example, it is bizarre that the specialist select committees that deal with subjects like health and education, the one thing they can't do is deal with legislation dealing with health and education. I know of no other parliament that has this bifurcation between legislative committees and investigative committees in the way that we have in this country. More radically, I wonder how many people have noticed that the UK is, along with its former colony Ireland, the only country in the EU that requires ministers also to be parliamentarians. There are quite a number of countries, France is one, the Netherlands is another, where you can be a minister without being an MP, and you can be appointed a minister from anywhere that the Prime Minister or the President decides. More commonly, you may be an MP, but you don't need to be an MP, so that it's open to an Angela Merkel to import into her governing administration people who were president of the Land, for example, and have not become members of the Bundestag. And it seems to me that the notion that our gene pool for the from which ministers are drawn should come exclusively from supporters, almost exclusively from supporters of the majority party in the House of Commons, is on the face of it a rather bizarre idea. And if you say, well, some of the people who've been parachuted in haven't worked very well, I offer you two thoughts. One is that some of the people who've been appointed from within haven't worked very well either. And also that at least some of the parachutees have done rather well. Winston Churchill knew what he was doing in 1940 when he appointed Ernest Bevin, who was was a trade union leader, not a member of parliament, to become Minister of Labour, and of course he went on to be a pretty good foreign secretary after the war. Officialdom worries me. This is a subject that, wearing my academic hat, I want to work at more systematically than anybody seems to have done so far. But very simply, my strong impression, and it's no more than that at the moment, but I think I'm probably right, is that whereas we once took it for granted that ministers took the difficult political decisions, gave their department a broad sense of direction, institutional memory was housed in the civil service, and it was civil servants who knew from their own experience about the work of their department. I think that is less and less true. Not because most civil servants are not able people, but because they lack the requisite training and they're moved around so often. The book contains a number of anecdotes. A chum of mine went to see some people in the Department for Education when it still was responsible for universities and was considering, this was in Labour days, 10 years or so ago, was considering accelerated two-year university degrees. There had been a government-sponsored report on that subject a generation before, which had poo-pooed the idea and given good reasons for doing that. My chum reported to me that none of the officials present had read the report and none of them had ever heard of it. Institutional memory, experience, knowledge. And I keep hearing stories of that character, and they're worrying. Let me throw one in to which I have no easy answers at all. Have you noticed, and I hadn't fully taken on board until I wrote this book, the odd circumstance that as the number of people who belong to political parties or are party activists has shrunk, and it shrunk by something like 90% since just after the Second World War, the power of those party members and activists has increased, so that they now elect the leaders of all the main parties. Now, if those people's views were representative of the views at least of the people who voted for their own party, but ideally of a broader swath of the electorate, that would not matter. But the evidence is pretty powerful that on the whole, the people who in 2015 choose to sign up to a political party have different views from the views even of the leaders of the party, let alone the views of ordinary constituents. As I say, what you do about that, I don't know. Let me just suggest that there are some institutional fixes. I've alluded to a few of them. But the central problem is probably one of mindset, of an insufficiency of pragmatism, an insufficiency of the desire to accept that things are problems and to set about dealing with those problems in as pragmatic and non-ideological a way and as non-partisan a way as is possible. In the book, and you may think of a better term, I refer to this as the Nordic style of government, where the aim of the game is to deliberate, to weigh up options and perhaps think of options that haven't occurred to people before, to consult very widely. If Mrs. Thatcher's people, if William Walgrave and others had asked people who were then known as town treasurers to tell them how they proposed to collect the poll tax, they would have been told that you couldn't collect the poll tax in many parts of Britain, and they would have been better advised. So you consult widely and meaningfully, not just a document sent out wanting responses to complicated questions in 3 weeks. It seems to me if you approach problems in that way, you are likely, as I've already hinted, to be concerned about doability, deliverability. Can this actually be made to happen on the ground? And you can take your time. Notice the number of governmental decisions, and in particular the number of blunders that appear to have been caused in large part by ministers acting at speed to the extent that sometimes I think they're actually on speed, as though there are very few decisions that have to be taken very quickly. I remember when I came to this country from Canada, I was told that one of the things that British political leaders prided themselves on was grasping nettles. And so I tried grasping a nettle. I'd never come across one before in Canada. And I thought this was a very odd way to behave. The Dutch have a phrase, if you have a hot potato, put it in the fridge. And typically, they don't leave it in the fridge indefinitely. They find means of extracting it from the fridge in better condition than it went in. And I think a number of things would follow from doing more things that way. One is probably that you'd achieve greater continuity with incoming governments less keen on undoing things that the existing government has already done. I think you'd find it easier to deal with some of these wicked issues if everybody was going to get involved, if all the stakeholders were going to get involved. You'd be more likely, not over-optimistic, but you'd be more likely to arrive at agreed solutions. And heaven knows, if our political class behaved in a more grown-up kind of way, it's just conceivable that the people now so alienated from our political class might be more respectful of them. And I think it is worth pointing out that degree of alienation is virtually unique to this country, and also for quite different reasons to the United States. Anyway, I live more in hope than expectation. As I said a moment ago, I'm not a huge optimist, but there have been occasions, for example, just before the Scottish referendum, when all the three major parties got together to agree on a programme of fiscal reform for Scotland. There have been occasions, the handling of Northern Ireland over a considerable period of time, when it's been possible to achieve a degree of cross-party consensus. And on the whole, I think it's better to strive for consensus than dissensus. Let me conclude by reading a short paragraph from this book, Who Governs Britain? I'm reading it partly to excuse the fact that I've just been talking about the UK, but it does illustrate the point, I think, tolerably well, or a number of points that I've been making. Ministers in successive governments have refused to make difficult decisions on defence. On the one hand, they want Britain to be able to punch above its weight in world affairs. On the other, they're reluctant to spend the money on Britain's military capabilities that would be essential if Britain were really to be able to do that. In both connections, they're inhibited by electoral considerations. They can't bring themselves to admit publicly that Britain can no longer rank as a world power and that defence spending can therefore be reduced substantially. But nor can they bring themselves either to raise more revenue for defence purposes or else to slash other budgets in the interests of bolstering the country's defences. Ministers fear the electoral consequences of doing either, so they do neither. The results are badly overstretched armed forces, aircraft carriers without aircraft, and a cadre of political leaders who, since they cannot punch above their weight, talk above their weight instead.
Anthony, thank you very much indeed for what is a splendidly provocative and thought-provoking talk. You were talking about the civil service influence on ministers, and it suddenly reminded me I have two ministerial offices. It always amused me to find that some of the minutes that came had two recommendations at the end, two possible solutions, and after them it always said, and we strongly advise the minister to take A rather than B. But others came with about 10 options at the end. It always said the minister will wish to consider these and decide which ones he wants to adopt. And I always took the view the first one was because the civil service knew what was right, and the second was because they didn't and they wanted the minister to take the blame for getting it wrong.